This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Daniel Aldrich, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University, currently on leave as a Fulbright Fellow at the University of Tokyo. He is author of the book, Site Fights, Divisive Facilities and Civil Society in Japan and the West, and his op-ed, How to Weather a Hurricane, was published in the New York Times last summer. Daniel Aldrich is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Building Resilience, Social Capital in Post-Disaster Recovery, published in 2012. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
What prompted you to do the research that led to your book, Building Resilience?
For me, this is really a personal project in many ways. My family and I had moved down to New Orleans, Louisiana, in the summer of 2005 in July. And we had 6 very good weeks there before our home, our car, everything we owned, our records, our computer, were all destroyed by the flooding after Hurricane Katrina. And the university that had employed me, Tulane University, was shut down for that semester. So I had about 4 months of time afterwards of unemployment when I began thinking about recovery, not just as an individual, but also as a community and a city. And from 2005, I began traveling to India, Japan, and parts of the Gulf Coast to understand around the world what factors made disaster resilience more likely and what factors sped up the process of recovery.
What is the goal of the work presented in the book? What question did you try to answer?
I wanted to understand what role social networks, our friends, our family, our colleagues, play in these processes of building resilience. I wanted to understand whether you're living in a small village in India or metropolitan Tokyo, what would make a difference for you? If, for example, your house were flooded or there was an earthquake that destroyed your home or if your business got shut down, I really wanted to see on the ground what aspects of these connections to other people made a difference in our lives.
What is your definition of disaster?
So in the book, I look closely at any event that killed more than 1,000 people and caused more than $500 million in damage. So I set the bar very high, more than just a small flood, for example, or a tornado or a car accident. I wanted to see in the most severe catastrophes that we've seen across the world, whether in 1923 in Tokyo, when roughly half the city was destroyed by an earthquake, or in 2004 in India, when a tsunami killed roughly 500,000 people across India, I wanted to understand in those large-scale disasters what made a difference in the processes of recovery.
Well, you've begun alluding to this, but would you describe the specific disasters you chose to study and explain why these particular disasters were chosen?
Sure. I wanted to make sure that any findings I discovered were robust across time and space so that you couldn't just argue, well, perhaps that was only the case in America or only the case in Japan. So I went back in time to 1923 here in Tokyo, Japan, and actually I found handwritten police records for about 15 years kept by individual police stations across Tokyo called koban in Japanese. And these record keepers worked before the 1923 disaster and then afterwards, writing down everything about their neighborhood. They wrote information about how many people lived there, how many cars were owned, levels of crime, who was marching in rallies, who was voting, very detailed information. So that was 1923 Tokyo. Then I looked at the 1995 Kobe earthquake, which killed roughly 8,000 people and, of course, was in a very highly dense area in the seaside town of Kobe here in Japan. I looked at the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, primarily in the areas of Tamil Nadu in India and small coastal villages there, very impoverished fishing villages. And then most recently was the Hurricane Katrina I myself went through. 2005, of course, in New Orleans, in Louisiana, in Baton Rouge and nearby, studying there again how survivors, people who came from New Orleans, dealt with the disaster.
What level of social organization did you focus on in evaluating resilience?
I really wanted to see the community level, so not a city level or neighborhood, but as close to a block level as possible, because all the interviews that we did across New Orleans, a colleague and I did several hundred of them across the city, what we found was that block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood, the levels of recovery, how people dealt with the disaster were quite different. You could have even people living half a mile away. Some communities had come back in their entirety. Village de l'Est, for example, a community mostly of Vietnamese and Vietnamese Americans in the northeast part of the city, did an amazing job of recovery. When several miles away in quite similar conditions, part of the lower Ninth Ward didn't seem to be doing as well. So I wanted to look really as closely as possible at individuals and communities and neighborhoods. So in all these disasters, whether in 1923 in Tokyo or in 2005 in New Orleans, I wanted to find as micro-level data as possible.
Would you elaborate on what you mean by social capital?
I think for most of us, it's an understanding that our daily lives are driven primarily by the networks of people that we interact with. It could be colleagues at work. It could be the neighbors who live nearby. It might be our parents or our children, if we're able to live in the same city with them. It could be a virtual network. We have friends through Facebook or LinkedIn and so forth. Social capital really defines the ties that bind us to other people nearby. In the book, I talk about different types of social capital. One is bonding social capital, which connects us to people who are quite similar to us. So, for example, if we're highly educated, middle-class African-Americans, probably our friends are quite similar in all three aspects. Bridging social capital, on the other hand, connects us with people who are different than us. So, for example, this might be groups in India that connect Hindu and Muslim communities. It might be groups in America that can connect Protestant and Catholic communities. It could be groups in Israel that connect Israeli and Palestinians. These are bridging groups that often form through clubs, through schools, bocce ball, opera, any kind of event that brings people together who are different. And the third and final type of capital we call linking social capital. Linking social capital means I, as a normal person, can connect with someone in authority and power. So perhaps I know someone in FEMA or someone in an NGO. I might know someone in World Vision if I live in India. Or maybe I know someone in the mayor's office if I live here in Tokyo.
How do you actually measure social capital?
So in different times and locations, those are quite different ways of capturing these ties. In the 1920s, I mentioned, we have these fantastic police records. And they kept track over time on a weekly basis the number of marches, rallies, and demonstrations. We know social capital helps to decrease the barriers to collective action. It means having a tie to someone else makes it more likely that we're going to work together with them to leave our homes, to go out and make a demonstration or a rally, to go out and vote, for example, on voting day, to get involved in pursuing aspects of a policy that matters to us. So for the 1920s Tokyo, we looked at the number of rallies and demonstrations that were there in the city at the time. In 1995 Kobe, on the other hand, we looked closely at what are called machizukuri, sort of community-building NGOs, non-governmental organizations. There we found that one of the best ways of capturing people's involvement in their community was the amount of time they invested and the number of organizations they joined to volunteer with. In India, in the 2000s, we found those didn't capture very well aspects of the informal networks that formed there. So we had several different things. We looked in India closely at the number of social events, especially weddings and funerals, that people living in these rural villages attended. More than voting, let's say, or getting involved in a formal group, we found in India those kind of informal associations really captured the depth of connection. And in Katrina in 2005, we captured social capital there by using voting turnout along with things like volunteering. So again, in different times and different locations, the ways that we form connections can be quite different. But at the end of the day, I think they work in a quite similar way. Those connections give us, at critical times, information and resources.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Daniel Aldrich, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University and author of the book, Building Resilience, Social Capital in Post-Disaster Recovery. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are the key findings of your studies?
I think most exciting for me were that more than other factors we typically think about, I think most of us imagine recovery as a process of economic or political strength. That is, when individuals or communities have more money, either because they were wealthier or because they got more aid from an NGO or a Red Cross or a FEMA, we often envision that that aspect of recovery, economics, will be important, or governance. I think many of us imagine that a community that's got a stronger mayor or a well-organized governor, perhaps a prime minister is paying attention, we envision governance will matter. But what I found actually was more than those aspects of life, the number of ties and the depth of those ties really determined recovery. So what we saw across time and space was that individuals, whether living in 1920s Tokyo, 2000s in India, or 2005 in Hurricane Katrina areas, we find that those individuals with better ties rebuilt their communities more quickly, told us that they felt more recovered, and also showed evidence of building back businesses and repopulating damaged areas. So for us, this is a very exciting finding because I think many of us still envision recovery both in terms of the amount of damage that was done. So, for example, if the storm did a lot of damage, we think the recovery processes will be slower. But what we found was actually damage was not a good predictor of the levels of recovery. Rather, again, it was the depth of ties and the types of ties people people had in their communities.
Would you elaborate on how or in what ways social capital works to aid recovery?
Great. Yeah, we think there are three different mechanisms that social capital works through. The first is through what we call decreasing exit and increasing voice. Economists have long argued that when there's a crisis or a problem, individuals have a choice. They can exit, they can leave the area and go someplace else, or they can use their voice, use their political will, try and make a change in the system. And what we found in interviewing survivors was that many people who had left their old communities left because they felt they could do a better life elsewhere. They put their kids in new schools, they purchased or rented a new house, they found a job in another community. But individuals who didn't use exit, individuals who stayed behind, they stayed behind in their communities because they felt strongly tied there. They had ties to neighbors, ties to friends and family who lived nearby, ties to businesses and to schools, ties to a sense of place. Perhaps their parents owned their house they'd lived in for many years. So individuals with deeper ties to their communities, they used voice and not exit. And of course, wherever we are, this is always the first choice for survivors. Do they decide to uproot themselves from a damaged home or a damaged condominium and make life elsewhere? Or do they stay in their area, whatever the costs, and rebuild? So that was the first mechanism, exit and voice. The second mechanism that we saw was that social capital overcame the barriers to collective action. Many of us feel strongly about issues. It could be gun control, it could be women's rights, it could be AIDS, HIV, whatever the issues that matter to us. Most of us don't spend our time going outside with placards or signs, going outside and petitioning the congressman. You know, we rely on other people to do that for us. We call this free riding. If I write a check to my organization, they'll go and make my voice heard. So after a disaster, many of the challenges that are faced by survivors are collective action problems. So for example, if we want to deter looting, keep out people who might steal from our community, it can't be just one person on patrol. You need as many families as possible to contribute time and effort to a looting patrol there in the area, community watch. So the more individuals that contribute to that effort, the more secure the neighborhood is. And we saw actually very amazing examples, both of failure of collective action and success. One example of success comes from that area in New Orleans I mentioned before, the Village de l'Est. There, less than 2 months after the disaster, many families wanted to come back to that area of New Orleans, and they did, around 500 families. But the power and gas were still turned off to most of the city. No one was back, really, on a broader scale. So these families called the local power utility called Entergy, and they asked for the power to be turned back on. And they were told if they could secure enough names on a petition to Entergy to prove they had a threshold of people there, they would have power back within a week. Every single family, 500 of them, had their names on a petition within a day. Amazing ability to work together, to find other people, to use email, texting, phones, and so forth to get themselves organized. In Kobe, about a decade before that, in 1995, after the earthquake there, the city of Kobe offered an amazing deal to every condominium owner. They told them if they would all sign off, every member of the condominium association, on this plan, the city would remove all of the garbage, all the debris, all the glass from their areas, from their private property. Fewer than half of the condominiums in Kobe ended up taking advantage of this deal. They simply didn't have the last names. They didn't have phone numbers or email addresses. They didn't know where they could find their neighbors to get their permission to sign on this form. So we have there one very successful outcome of collective action and one big failure. And I think the third mechanism through which social capital works is what we call informal insurance or mutual aid. After a disaster, the normal providers of services, for example, child care services at local daycare or schools, medical services through hospitals or doctors, gasoline through gas stations, food through local stores, almost all of those are shut down. It could be for days, it could be for weeks or for months. I remember the parts of New Orleans that didn't have gas stations for almost 3 months afterwards. So in those moments of crisis, what we found was that individuals with deeper connections were able to get those resources they needed. So for example, if your house was rotting from the inside and you had no power tools to remove the drywall, if your neighbors had a tool, you could borrow it from them if they knew you, of course, and trusted you. Walmart wasn't open, no local stores are open. If you had to put your child with someone for the day as you're looking for a new job, oftentimes you couldn't find a professional daycare provider, but maybe a grandparent or a friend nearby might be home and could help you. If you needed information on how to, for example, reconnect your electricity to the grid, again, websites were down, Entergy wasn't answering its phone, but if you had friends who had that knowledge, you could get that. So we find at these moments of crisis, you get informal insurance. That is, you can't pay for it with money. It doesn't matter if you're wealthy or you're poor. Rather, you have to invest in these relationships in communities in order to be able to get those resources at critical moments. So all these mechanisms, the concepts of exit and voice, overcoming collective action problems, and informal insurance, those are really the biggest problems in the first few weeks and months after disaster. Working together as a community, getting information, and ensuring you have people coming back to the area so you won't have a ghost town afterwards.
Would you say more about post-Katrina neighborhoods that did the best or worst in New Orleans from the point of view of social capital?
Yes, we had some very interesting studies, actually of my old neighborhood called Lakeview, of the Lower Ninth Ward, and of Village de l'Est, this Vietnamese community. What we found was that the Lakeview community, actually had very low levels of bonding social capital. That is, the connections between, for example, neighbors and friends were quite similar. And we think this was because many of the individuals there were quite wealthy. Many of them worked long hours at their jobs and didn't spend much time, for example, in local events, barbecues, and so forth. But what they had in Lakeview was very strong linking social capital. Many individuals in the community knew members of the mayor's office, knew members of FEMA, and could get directed aid by utilizing those resources. In the Lower Ninth Ward, we found very, very high levels of bonding social capital. Their number of church organizations, social events, barbecues, crews, K-R-E-W-E-S, these are the social clubs that get involved in the Mardi Gras. These groups had very high levels of bonding social capital, but very few bridging and linking connections. So, for example, in interviews, people couldn't name organizations outside the area that they'd worked with, or they couldn't name someone in the mayor's office they knew personally. So that was a connection they were lacking. Similarly, in the area of Village de l'Est, we found they had both very high levels of bonding social capital. So they organized around the Mary Queen of Vietnam Church, MQVN, run by Pastor Dien there. They had very strong levels of trust, and they had connections both in the mayor and governor officers, these linking social capital. So we found those types of connections after New Orleans made a big difference for being on the map, so to speak, of not only getting aid, but directing it where it needs to go. The city or the government may have a plan in mind for your community which doesn't match your vision. And it really requires collective action, working together as a community, to get a better policy plan put in place. If members of a community aren't well organized, they don't have connections, they're not making the difference, getting their voices out there, it's much more difficult for them to have their plans taken seriously by policy planners, by city planners, and so forth. So of those communities, unfortunately, even today, Lower Ninth Ward still has a lower population level than it did beforehand. Village de l'Est and Lakeview seem to have recovered pretty well compared to pre-disaster recovery levels.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Daniel Aldrich, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University and author of the book Building Resilience, Social Capital in Post-Disaster Recovery. You report some negative effects of social capital in your book. Would you like to talk about those negative effects?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting. Social capital can work as a double-edged sword in several ways. As I mentioned already, by having strong bonding or bridging or linking ties, you can make it more likely that you'll work together. But by having those strong connections to people who are like you, for example, that can also mean you shut out individuals who are different than you. And in several of the studies that I did in the book, what we found was that very tightly integrated groups that worked well together, often shut out individuals different than them. Those could be a minor level shutout, that is, they might not put them on the list of survivors to get aid, or it could be a seriously violent reaction. We saw, for example, in 1923 in Tokyo, after the earthquake, that a number of Koreans, we estimate more than 3,500 Koreans, were actually killed in riots that broke out across the city. There had been false rumors that Koreans living in Tokyo had been poisoning the wells and causing fires, that they were somehow undermining social fabric of the community. Many of the Koreans living there were killed. And in fact, only recently have there been open discussions of the massacres that took place after the disaster. So, of course, this is far worse than just looting, let's say, or stealing. This was directed violence at an out group, a group that was different than the mainstream Japanese people living in Tokyo at the time. And again, we don't have great data on this, but we assume that those communities that were the best organized, that were best integrated, were able to identify individuals living there who were different than the mainstream Japanese. We also know in 2004 in India that many of the untouchables called Dalit there were left off, either deliberately or unconsciously, by the organizers of many, many communities that were asking for aid. So literally they'd have names of everyone in the Patanavar fishing caste, but they wouldn't have the names of individuals who are Dalits. And we found very strong evidence that access to aid was predicated on being in this in-group, being a part of a certain caste or a certain group. So in this way, social capital can cut both ways. It can organize your community, ensure you're coming back as a group, help you work together to bring in aid, but it can also mean, if highly insulated or isolated, that you'll deliberately shut out or unconsciously shut out groups that are different than you. And I think this is the struggle, both for communities themselves, but also providers after disaster, whether they're NGOs or governments. How do we balance the fact that well-organized communities, whether in Japan, for example, or in India, might not necessarily see everyone as part of the same community and might leave people out of that process?
How helpful was government aid in the disasters you examined?
We didn't find a lot of evidence that aid by itself was a great predictor of long-term recovery or even median-term population recovery. What we found, actually, and one of my colleagues, Rieko Kage, here in Tokyo, has done great research on this, was that the interaction between government aid and social capital was the most critical. That is, not just giving money to build back, let's say, bridges or schools or roads, but having the interaction with the community that has a strong bottom-up push and are well integrated into things that are going on, that directs the money toward projects that are necessary. We actually saw in India, in fact, government aid and aid from NGOs often damaged existing social capital structures. Many NGOs who came into India after the tsunami wanted to have their brands on the products they had given. So rather than branding, let's say, homes or branding the individual money they gave back, they branded boats. And they gave a lot of boats out to the point where what had previously been a 5-person fishing operation, each member of the crew now had their own boat, which may have sounded like a good idea at first, but of course, this breaks apart the social hierarchy in the boat and also makes it harder to differentiate who does what task if you have your own boat. So you have to go from being a pilot to being a fisher, from being a fisher to being someone who carries the fish under the beach and sells them at the market. So that tremendous amount of aid was actually called the second tsunami by many people I spoke to there in India. So overall, I would say, certainly aid helps out to some degree, but social capital can better direct that aid and ensure the money is used well and goes to projects that are necessary and helpful, as opposed to going to a waste. We know, for example, here in Japan, after last year's Tohoku disaster, roughly 1/5 of the money that was supposed to have gone to local communities has in fact not gone there. It's gone to projects in Okinawa, which is over 1,000 miles away from some of these areas. It's gone to bridges being built elsewhere in Japan. There really hasn't been a strong aspect of local involvement in the direction of these funds. So I think funds by themselves, government aid by itself, isn't necessarily a panacea post-disaster.
Based on your studies, what are your policy recommendations for disaster planning? How can your ideas be applied to future disaster recoveries?
I think the good news is that if these social networks are a critical part of recovery, then our goal really should be to work with local communities, especially vulnerable communities, like the Gulf Coast communities in America or coastal communities in India, to build up these social ties before the next disaster. And in the book, I discuss several different mechanisms that are being tested around the world, some in areas like Nicaragua and South Africa, that have been proven, actually, to build up trust and resilience in communities. One of them involves a very simple process of simply encouraging local people to get to know their neighbors. So that is, like Mr. Rogers said so long ago, knowing your neighbor can really help. In many cases, the people who survived disasters like earthquakes in Japan were saved not by first responders, police officers, firefighters, National Guardsmen, but rather by their neighbors who knew where they had slept in the building that collapsed and could dig for them. Similarly, in India and in Tohoku, many times the tsunami had a warning beforehand, but you had to have someone who helps you out of a bed if you're bedridden or if you're elderly. So those kind of individual connections are really critical. At a larger level, at the community level, we know that block grants in Japan support community activities called matsuri or festivals here, and those can really bring people together to build that bridging social capital across ethnicities, across religions and backgrounds. We also know that focus groups, that is, regular meetings of individual for any purpose, it could be about environmental questions, it could be about HIV/AIDS or women's rights, whatever the goal is, we know that regular meetings build up social capital and trust among the participants. And finally, we know that from experiments, both in Japan, America, and Canada, actually, that community currency, that is, rewarding individuals who volunteer in their communities with money that can only be spent at local businesses. So if I volunteer at an elderly home nearby or at a school or at a hospital, I'm paid back not in dollars or yen, but in money that can only be spent at mom-and-pop stores at a local food bank, perhaps a farmer's market or a barbershop. It can't be spent at McDonald's or Walmart. This keeps the money and the volunteering in the community. And when I volunteer, earn these points or money and spend them locally, then I connect to local businesses who now have local money themselves, and they spend the money locally. So we create this virtual cycle of volunteering and involvement. So we think these four plans, individuals connecting to their neighbors, more involvement at the block level, regular focus groups, and community currency, all of these are ways to build up social capital in communities around the world.
Overall, to what extent is social capital being taken into account in current disaster planning?
You know, I'm really optimistic right now. I've been consulting with a number of different cities and national-level planning organizations. San Francisco, for example, has a full-time individual whose only job right now is to help build resilience and connections, not at the city level, but block by block. Right now, Australia, the Red Cross there, is building a series of new documents for use there across Australia that are focusing on social capital and community ties. Japan as well, in Fukushima and other parts of the nation, are using social capital as a serious part of the rebuilding process, trying to rebuild damaged social networks, ensure that mothers and children, for example, have a broader network of support. I think I'm very optimistic right now. We see a lot of movement from policymakers and recognizing that the old way of dealing with disaster, which is simply, you know, send in some rice, send in engineers to build new bridges and roads, that old way of dealing with disaster isn't going to be sufficient for the future. As we have global warming, rising seas, more flooding disasters, more extreme weather, we know there'll be more disasters. So simply infrastructure by itself won't be enough. But the social infrastructure, I think we're seeing a lot more investment in that than we used to.
Would you go into some more detail about the efforts in the United States to incorporate social capital into disaster planning?
Sure. San Francisco has an Office of Resilience now, run by Dan Holmsey. And what he's doing, actually, is working literally block by block to organize individuals. And they each appoint a block leader whose garage or home becomes sort of a local staging area. So they've agreed, if there's a disaster, as we know there will be in the next 20 or 30 years in the Bay Area, individual garages and homes become staging areas for food, for water, for medical care, and for information. So that rather than relying on FEMA or the Red Cross to come into San Francisco and provide, let's say, a tent city someplace else, each individual block has its own store of resources, information, again, where to get information on what's open and what's closed, is there gas or food available nearby, on medical supplies, if we need bandages, if we need tourniquets, if we need antibiotics, this would be provided on a block-by-block level, and also, more broadly speaking, information. So these block leaders of each block in San Francisco know locally who needs a wheelchair, who needs diabetes medicine, who has special needs. And what we've found time and time again is no one government agency has a list of individuals who need help, who need wheelchairs, and so forth. Here in Japan, for example, after the Tohoku disaster, many of those people who perished in the tsunami were individuals who were bedridden or elderly. They simply did not have time to get out by themselves. And no one knew they needed help. They didn't have a caretaker nearby or friends or family to get them out. So San Francisco is being proactive now and trying to get lists of individuals. What medications do they need? What special help do they need? With the idea that when the next disaster strikes, rather than waiting for those individuals to save themselves or be saved randomly, they'll get help from people who live nearby, who know them and know their conditions.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Now, I think all of us can build up resilience individually and in communities. Even people who are reluctant to go out and get involved can learn a little bit about their neighbors. Getting involved in community activities, whether synagogues, churches, religious activities, in sports, in clubs nearby, in volunteering, all of these activities that draw us closer to our neighbors are ways that we can individually and on a community level prepare for future events.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Daniel.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have just been listening to Daniel Aldrich, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University and author of the book Building Resilience, Social Capital and Post-Disaster Recovery, published in 2012 by the University of Chicago Press. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.